Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be introducing this episode. A few days ago, an old They Might Be Giants song snuck into my head. It goes something like this. Me, 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 me. All right, I won't sing it. Where your eyes don't go, a filthy scarecrow waves his broomstick arms and does a parody of each unconscious thing you do. When you turn around to look, it's gone behind you. On its face, it's wearing your confused expression. Where your eyes don't go. Where your eyes don't go, a part of you is hovering. It's a nightmare that you'll never be discovering. Sorry. If you've ever heard that song before, it's probably stuck in your head now. There are worse fates, I suppose. So my own personal filthy scarecrow started whispering in my ear. And soon it led me to its favorite session at the 2022 Sunstone Summer Symposium. It's called The Jungian Shadow and Mormon History, presented by Valerie Hammaker. Valerie has a master's degree in counseling from Mid-America Nazarene University and owns an independent marriage and family counseling practice. She's also the creator and host of the Latter-day Struggles podcast.
I want to have a conversation with you about what it means to be human, about the strengths and weaknesses. There was a man, or is a man, by the name of Andrew Lynn. He's an astronomer from the British Isles, and he made a phenomenal discovery. He actually discovered a planet that survived the explosion of a supernova. It was so powerful that it actually darkened a neighboring galaxy for several days, and somehow this planet survived. He and his team were amazed that this could possibly be, and they went through all this energy and effort to talk about how this could be, and they wrote a paper, and it got out in the scientific community, and it was a really big deal. And he started going on the circuit, and before his first talk, which was here in the United States, he had a moment. He must have been checking his math. Something occurred to him, and he realized that a foundation principle, it was one of those little tiny detail, mathematical details that changed everything and completely obliterated his entire concept. So he was in a position where he had to decide, what am I going to do? I'm a super brilliant scientist. How many people are going to check me? Would my team even check me? Can I move forward and just hold on to the myth of what this is? He had a choice to make, and he had this, and this is what all of us have to do at some point in time. We have a me self, the way I want you to see me. And in his case, he probably, his me self, his persona, was, I want to be seen as brilliant, thorough, wise, precise, and exacting. In this moment, he had to confront the reality that he was also dull, sloppy, foolish, and disorganized. He made a mistake. And he decided to own it. He stood up before the scientific community. They were prepared to hear this brilliant conversation about his discovery. And he says, I stand before you to say the whole thing is wrong. My calculations were wrong. I have nothing to share with you other than the admission of my own humanity. And the entire audience stood up and gave him a round of standing ovation. And someone in the audience afterwards said it was the greatest moment in my professional career of complete and utter integrity. They didn't use the word shadow in this conversation, but this is exactly what he was able to own. He was able to take in the fullness of the good things that he in fact was, but also the dark side of himself, and he was able to have enough of an ego structure or a sense of his own innate goodness to encompass also the things that he was that he really would rather not be. And that is actually what the shadow is. We all have a shadow. Carl Jung says, the shadow is simply the thing I do not wish to be. However, these are my words, however I am. I am both of these things. The shadow lives at the very top of our unconsciousness. It refers to the part of the unconscious that is very nearest the conscious or the ego state, even though it is not completely accepted by the consciousness. And so it's like we know it's there, we don't want to know it's there, we pretend it's not there, we spend a lot of time navigating around the idea that it's probably not there, but it actually is there. And so we spend a lot of energy trying to not own our shadow part. The problem is it gets us into a lot of trouble. So just a couple of quick components about the shadow. Each of us has one. No one rides for free on this. I like to think of Peter Pan. He lost his shadow, and it was a big problem. He really, really wanted his shadow. I think that's really beautiful. There's a lot of Jungian concepts in that. He needed it. He was not whole or complete without it. These shadows develop early in our lives, and they basically happen when we map the world around us, especially those most influential characters around us, and we learn what is and is not acceptable about our identities, about ourselves. And then we create an identity, a me self, and we also kind of put in a metaphorical bag the not me self. We put it away and pretend like it's not there, but it is, of course, there. Okay, so these shadows vary person to person, family to family, church to church, culture to culture. So something that may be in my shadow bag because of my family is not going to be in your shadow bag because you weren't messaged that there was something wrong with that thing. And so shadows are actually very, very idiosyncratic. We have a hard time knowing our shadow. We spend a lot of time evading it and denying it. But the shadow always has a way of coming forward, and they are revealed to us in uncomfortable confrontations with others. Most of the time, these shadow experiences come forward when we least want them to be, and we start to notice that we're sort of playing some games to deny them. Husband in the house. Okay, so this guy and I have a pretty decent marriage, and I consider myself, my me self, is that I'm a pretty good lady. And I consider myself, you know, like pretty forgiving and patient, all those things, until you put me behind the boat on a pair of slaloms, on one slalom ski, and he's driving. And then it gets really ugly really fast. Am I right, babe? I learned how to water ski behind another boat with another person, and she actually is the only one that knows how to do it right, okay? He does it all wrong, and it's completely his fault. So it's one of those things where my shadow self is, I hold on to it, my me identity, but I notice that the ugliest parts of me come out because it's his fault that he can't get me up on a pair of slalom skis. And this has been going on for many, many years, right? And so I've had to acknowledge to myself all of the games I play in my head where I really have to take ownership of how I'm not a nice person. I blame him. I self-deceive about all the reasons why this is his problem. I self-justify my bad behavior. I see myself as a little bit better than him. Like, well, if he, then I. Like, I do all sorts of these things to maintain my identity of myself until I have to take a close look at myself and say, no, like, this is a Valerie problem. This is where your dark side comes out. We all have moments and opportunities to do this. So what we do when we deny the shadow is we become overcommitted to whoever we want ourselves to be. So we become overcommitted to our self-image, and we really spend a lot of time trying to pretend like we're always that thing. When we experience a shadow itself or a shadow part come out, something that we don't want to be, it emerges in some sort of a relational confrontation, we experience some variation of self-deception and self-justification. I find those two are really close cousins, right? Like, our self-justification is a way to deceive ourselves. I'm not that person. Therefore, whatever I'm doing is their fault. Okay? And then as we do that, we're getting in less and less touch with our true whole selves. We're not acknowledging this is my problem, and we basically have to turn the problem onto you. This is not about me. I have to maintain my goodness, my patience, my whatever. And so then I turn into kind of a crappy person. I'm grandiose. I think I'm better than you. Because I notice there's something, you know, remember, the shadow sort of hovers at the top of the subconsciousness. I see badness. I don't want to own it, so I hand it to you. And then I'm pretty hostile and judgmental of you. Owning up to the shadow is not nearly as damaging as in the long run as denying it. And this is actually kind of a lifelong endeavor. We have to consistently always be trying to address that, you know what, this life is about learning how to become whole. Not perfect, but whole. And wholeness is inclusive of all of those parts of ourselves that we're just not very comfortable with. We have to become okay with those, because if we don't become okay with those, then really bad things can happen to us. So how do I integrate my shadow? I have to awaken and heighten my awareness. I have to become actively aware of how unaware I have been. Essentially, I'm saying I own what I've been trying to not own. I have to look at myself and acknowledge that I'm not nice sometimes, that I'm impatient sometimes, that I'm self-justifying, that I'm judgmental. Like, whatever that thing is that we kind of hold on to and put in our little shadow bags, we have to just own that it's there. And the beautiful thing is, the shadow is not all evil. Sigmund Freud had his ideas that the shadow was all darkness. Carl Jung came forward and said, not necessarily. The shadow is the thing that we have defined as bad and evil, but they're actually adaptive parts of us that we put in the shadow. They're not all bad. It's just that we have to take ownership of the wholeness of these things. So for example, if somebody says, they get the idea that selfishness is always bad, they put that selfishness in the shadow bag, then they're never going to learn how to be self-advocating. They're not going to take the good part of selfishness and take care of themselves. So by disowning these shadow parts, they're actually very, very underdeveloped. They hurt themselves and they hurt others. So I have to take ownership of my unawareness, my humanity. We have to be actively aware of our hubris, our arrogance, this idea that I think I've got it all figured out and I don't have anything to work on. But you sure do, right? We have to become actively aware of our grandiosity, the sense that we have sometimes that we have it figured out and that you don't and that we're better than you. And then finally, the self-deception and justification, which is sort of the games that we play with ourselves to not look at ourselves. So in short, it's all about self-confrontation, which is the heart and soul of growth. We have to look at ourselves and acknowledge that there's something beautiful about our messiness, that humanity is all about owning the fullness of ourselves, and that we are infinitely lovable already, just as we are. There's a firewall between our lovability and anything that we do, our shadow selves, our mistakes, our problems, our weaknesses. Those are things that we are here in life to become aware of and to, with lots of self-compassion, embrace and own and love and do so in a way that is self-honoring and honoring to others. But it's part of our wholeness and our humanity, and self-confronting is the road to wholeness. All right, so some experts in Jungian theory say the aim of meeting the shadow is to develop an ongoing relationship with it, to expand our senses of self by balancing the one-sidedness of our conscious attitudes with our unconscious depths. Growth is all about awakening the unconscious, making the unconscious conscious. There's some ruins. It's called the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, and there are some inscriptions. There are several, there are actually over 100, I think I read somewhere, 169 ruins with all of these beautiful, wise inscriptions, and these three are in this one temple, and they actually speak perfectly to the growth of the soul. Point number one, know thyself. Now, we never are going to fully know ourselves, right? And I think that's why psychologists talk about our learning to acquire a sense of self. The idea of knowing ourselves is being able to tolerate our full selves. The next one is nothing in excess. Now, I thought this was fascinating, and I really kind of gave this some thought. Because, you know, if you think about this on first blush, it's like, well, what about excessive holiness? What about excessive goodness, excessive patience or honesty or whatever? The problem is when we are excessively any one thing, we're denying the fact that as humans, we hold both. And remember, if we don't acknowledge the one, it oftentimes creeps up through the floorboards. And then we do bad things, and we somehow figure out a way to self-justify that it's not a bad thing, because we're so overcommitted to the thing that we think we have to be, that we get ourselves in a lot of trouble. And then the third one is surety brings ruin, back to arrogance and hubris. Okay, so let's talk about a success story. I have always loved the story of King David. And so let's just talk a little bit about how David confronted his shadow. We all know that the beginning of his story was this day when he couldn't sleep one night and he winds up on his balcony and he sees Bathsheba over bathing on her balcony. And I like to think of this, when I think of this from a Jungian perspective, that he began to engage in sort of the slippery slope of shadow boxing, where he was trying to not look at his shadow. He was, as we often all are, extremely committed to our me states. We want to be seen as, and this is, you know, this is the endeavor to become the best versions of ourselves. So it's not all bad, right? It has to be balanced, right? So I like to think of David as thinking of himself as, I am beloved, I am good, I am noble, I'm powerful, I'm influential. Shadow work is hard for all of us. But I think it's harder for those in positions of power where they have specific roles that they have been asked to participate. In other words, it's like, not only do I have this expectation of what it means to be a king, but you have an expectation of me. So I feel very compelled to put on a show and not show either you or me my humanity. Okay, so those in power really struggle, I'm going to say maybe even more than the rest of us. Okay, so let's just imagine as he kind of goes down this downward spiral that leads to the pregnancy of Bathsheba, that then leads to his sort of conniving to get Uriah back at home so that he can frame the whole situation up and be unaccountable, how this doesn't work, and then of course he sends Uriah to the front lines to be killed. So in my mind, this is a classic example of what happens when our shadow denial goes out of control. And when one little justification moves to another justification and it moves to the sense of mistreatment of others to justify ourselves, and I imagine David's grandiosity. And a grandiosity, by definition, is a sense that I am entitled to something. I'm entitled to your wife. I am better than you. You may not have said that, but those of us who struggle with not owning the fullness of ourselves, we tend to think we are a little bit above the rules, right? And then scapegoating, which is looking at other people as having the problem and not us. It's just this massive sense of self, of denying one's own humanity. The beautiful thing is that although he really did sort of spiral down for a while, someone stopped him in his tracks. Prophet Nathan comes in and tells him a metaphorical story of somebody who deeply took advantage of someone else. Someone took someone else's possession, which is sort of problematic from a patriarchal perspective, but that's for another day. And how David is listening to this story and he's seeing somebody done wrong, something taken from this man in the story. And David is like, this is horrible. How could somebody be allowed to do that thing? I can't believe. And he's really, really scandalized by this thing that Nathan tells him. And I only imagine that Nathan looked at David and there was a long pause for drama. And he said, David, you're the man. I'm talking about you. You took something that was not yours. It wasn't anybody's. She belonged to herself. And David came to himself in that moment and he self-confronted. And he owned his shadow and he recognized, what have I done? Perhaps it is in what we do not accept about ourselves, our aggression and shame, our guilt and our pain, that we discover our humanity. And I'm touched by a king with a lot of legitimate power that had been given him, who had the courage and the wisdom to see himself as wounded and broken and as having done something very bad. I want to just paraphrase some of the words from the 51st Psalm, where David shares with us his own journey to the confrontation of his shadow and how he evolved. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all of my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all of my iniquity. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Open my lips, Lord, and my mouth will declare your praise. This is David's psalm of repentance, specifically about what he did to hurt himself and others through his relationship with Bathsheba. Only those who know their capacity for lust, greed, rage, gluttony, and for all things excessive, who have understood and accepted their own potential for inappropriate extremes, can choose to regulate and humanize their actions. Integration of the shadow is always concurrent with the dissolution of the false persona. One becomes much more realistic about oneself. Seeing the truth about one's own nature always has salutary effects. Honesty is the greatest defense against genuine evil. When we stop lying to ourselves about ourselves, that is the greatest protection we have against evil. And I want to talk a little bit about our own founder, Prophet Joseph Smith, and how his story went a different way. I believe that in many ways, King David and the prophet Joseph Smith were very, very similar. Both of them were beloved of God and always have been and always will be. They are children of God. And remember, if we can be wounded and broken and make big mistakes and still be eternally beloved, so can they. Both were very human. Both were very powerful. Both were very charismatic. Both were men that lived in a world where men had power over women, and both seemed to have experiences of being at war with themselves around issues of patriarchy, power, and sex. Both of them probably had rather similar me selves, right? What they wanted, how they wanted to be seen. And in many ways, they probably were these things: noble, humble, good, honorable, trustworthy, and righteous. They're not me selves, sinful, prideful, selfish, entitled, dishonorable, deceitful, and manipulative. And once again, both of us are the composite of all, you know, we each have the fullness of both sides, right? The only problem comes when we deny this other side of ourselves and don't have an awareness of it. To the extent that we aren't aware of it, does it take over, right? And both had a lot of power in their roles, and so there were specific expectations that they probably placed on themselves, which made them particularly vulnerable to not looking at their shadows. My feeling is that Joseph Smith was not evil and did prophetic things. I believe that. I believe there was a lot of prophetic activities that happened. I also believe that he lost touch with his humanity and his shadow. I talked about David with his experience with Bathsheba, and I'm going to just stay with Joseph Smith and his experience with the very complex conundrum of his beginning polygamy and polyandry. Let's just talk a little bit about how I feel like his unresolved shadow hovers around issues of power over, the need, desire for validation, affirmation. And I feel like that was both gendered. In other words, it wasn't just with women in this case. There was a lot of unresolved shadow around the need for wanting to be known and seen as powerful, as good, as holy, as righteous, as infallible, things like that. And I think there was a second unresolved shadow, which was his struggles with how to relate to women. And then the third one, of course, hovers around the issue of sexuality. He was not alone in that. These struggles, power over women and sexuality, is an inheritance of the history of the world. So it is not sort of a unique thing that we struggle with in our tradition. I do think there are some unique expressions of it that we hold as a church tradition, but really we are in a world where this has been a complex collective shadow that we have carried with us from the beginning of time. Little spheres of influence cause little problems. Larger spheres of influence cause larger problems. And because he did restore truths, covenants, ordinances, things like that, it brought up a lot of potential for a lot of struggle. I'm going to begin with extreme commitment and active image management. His desired me self was, I am a prophet. Prophets do good things. If I fill or do this, and I'm not a bad guy because I'm a prophet, therefore I can't do bad things, so I have to do these things and turn the bad things into good things. That kind of sounded messy, but maybe his brain, like, I think sometimes when we kind of get confused and we're trying to, like, rationalize things, it gets kind of messy. And so I think that's kind of where the self-justification and the self-deception began. How can I be feeling what I'm feeling if I'm a prophet? And therefore, he actually had some low-hanging fruit by doing the translation of the Bible. I'm kind of riffing off of what Carolyn Pearson speculates from her Ghosts of Polygamy book, which was a good man trying his hardest to do prophetic things while also being a human man with unresolved shadow struggles, trying to make sense of his own experience, and so turning something that was never okay, even in biblical times, into something that was okay, and kind of going down this like a rabbit hole of self-justification and self-deception. So the self-deception that sort of, I think, began small and then sort of snowballed had to do with his experience of and the deceit that was practiced between himself and his own first wife. Many public statements of denial that happened throughout the history of polygamy up into his martyrdom. And a lot of the doublespeak. You know, if it's called this, it's okay. If it's called that, it's not okay. If I say it's okay, but if you do the same thing, it's not okay. And I think it became very, very, some sophisticated ways of self-justifying and self-deceiving. I'm going to talk just a second about some of what Todd Compton, but his book, In Sacred Loneliness, goes really deeply into these ideas of the elaborate self-justification that happens regarding the polyandry specifically. And there were three. One of them is, there's this idea of kindred spirits, and Compton makes clear that this is not a unique early Mormon kind of struggle. This was actually fairly common in the Burnt Over District of New York, that then there were other evangelical and Protestant belief systems around this idea that we marry for necessity until we find that kindred spirit, and then it's okay to take someone else's wife or to do this because that was the true sort of this is when true love finally happens. So there's that one. And the second one is this idea that higher priesthood trumps lower priesthood. And there's quite a bit there where there was a little bit of a complex way of justifying that if I have more power and the woman is complicit and she wants this, and even the male partner sometimes is involved. Of his 11 polyandrous relationships, many of them were his close friends' wives. And Todd Compton believes that it's likely that because of the charisma of Joseph Smith, and because he was, I believe, he really thought he had convinced himself so much that this was okay that he charismatically convinced everybody else that was okay. And it was complicated because he once again did prophetic things. It was really complicated. And so he actually looped these other men into it, at least that's Compton's speculation, and they colluded in it because they wanted to sort of ride on the coattails of the exaltation that happened when you were connected with somebody with higher priesthood through your wife. And the third one is, if you were not married under the restored priesthood, restored by himself, your marriage didn't matter anyways, whether it was civil or from any other faith tradition, which then, therefore, kind of made all of these other marriages null and void anyways, and therefore it was sort of free game. So I'm hoping you're kind of understanding, like, this is complex self-justification that he really, I do believe he believed. And so this was his way that things sort of started spinning further and further out of control. And I do believe that they all tied back into this unresolved shadow self. I'm not bad. I'm good. I'm a good guy. I'm called of God. I translated a holy book of scripture, which was all true, but it was just this sense of like, I can't stop myself. And so there was this part of the grandiosity is the entitlement that he felt that he could follow a different set of rules. The creation of an in-group where some of the people that he involved with kind of protected him. And they also kind of got this higher, the higher reward for the collection of wives in the next life. And just basically the treatment of women, blunted judgment, blunted ability to discern their pain, and blunted sense of impact and consequences, and how many women he hurt. Of course, the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants is intriguing. I've always been really bothered that, like, why does David not get to be exalted, right? Why is the atonement outside of David's sin when we know from the 51st Psalm, he was forgiven, and it occurred to me that this is possibly Joseph in battle with himself, that he scapegoated David. Four different times he said that this plural marriage is okay, just don't kill anybody, which is basically in my mind saying, I'm not David, I didn't kill Uriah. And then his idea of scapegoating David and saying, because he did that, he says, therefore he hath fallen from his expectation. This is a scapegoating. I'm not bad, but he is. I didn't do this. I did this stuff, but that's okay because he's different than me. I don't know, but it's things that I think about because it is my deep belief that the atonement is big enough to encompass the prophet David. And then to end, just the hostility, just the one little tiny example I'll offer is what happened with the destruction of the expositor. These were some of his friends, and so he felt betrayed, but these were people that were trying to be his Nathans. They were trying to confront him. They were trying to help him see himself and see what destruction was happening already and was going to happen if he kept going down this path. Now we come to a sort of paradox. People hiding from the shadow feel themselves to be guiltless, but at the same time, they have an unacknowledged sense of their own self-deception. It is a sense from which they frantically trying to flee. The essential component of this experience is not the absence of a sense of sin or imperfection, but the unwillingness to tolerate that sense. The self-deceived are aware of their evil and desperately trying to avoid the awareness, continually engaging in sweeping the evidence of their evil under the rug of their own consciousness. I feel that Joseph probably had a few Nathan characters and that he was not able, for his own reasons, his own struggles with his shadow, he was not able to push them away. Oliver Cowdery and Oliver's valiant efforts to help Joseph see himself. Just to give you a little bit of a timeline of what happened, I'm going to just refer here now to Joseph's first extramarital relationship with Fanny Alger. In 1835, there was a fierce argument between Joseph and Emma, And Fanny Alger was thereafter expelled from the home, and Oliver was actually called in to mediate this argument between Joseph and Emma. Shortly thereafter, Joseph left for a few days with Frederick G. Williams, during which time Oliver wrote and published something called an article on marriage denying polygamy, and this was presented and accepted before the church in the absence of Joseph Smith. Okay, so he tried, I think, to intervene and help the situation. I think he was trying to save Joseph from himself. This is Compton's feeling. Although Oliver tried to protect and help, it seems like it was at that point where he began to lose respect for his esteemed colleague, Joseph. And I can only imagine how heartbreaking this was. He was one of the three witnesses. He helped translate the Book of Mormon. He was key to the beautiful, beautiful foundations of the Restoration. And he confronted something that he couldn't tolerate. He tried to protect and help. Their relationship continues to dissolve and deteriorate between 1837 and 1838. And there's record that Oliver says after the fact, "I never denied, and I never was." He couldn't deny what he saw and how he felt about it. He said, "This isn't right. The situation that I have encountered with you, I cannot accept, Joseph." Rather than Joseph being able to tolerate that and look at himself, he was very convinced, I think, of the rightness of his situation, and he had his story in his head, that rather than embracing this and confronting his shadow, he excommunicated Oliver in 1838. And Oliver said later in a letter to his brother, he criticized the church for endeavoring to make it a rule of faith for said church to uphold a certain man or men, right or wrong. I kind of feel like we were getting there. There was, at the end of Joseph's life, I think the thing began to spin out of control enough that we were getting close, but I think it had already gone so far, and I believe, like I said, it's a tangled web. It's very, very hard after what had developed and how many people had become involved in this very, very messy situation. As a matter of fact, William Marks records this. This comes from In Sacred Loneliness also. When the doctrine of polygamy was introduced to the church as a principle for exaltation, I took a decided stand against it, which stand rendered me quite unpopular with many of the leading ones of the church. Joseph, however, became convinced before his death that he had done wrong. For about 3 weeks before his death, I met him one morning in the street, and he said to me, "Brother Marks, we are ruined people." I said, "How so?" He said, "This doctrine of polygamy, or the spiritual wife system, that has been taught and practiced among us will prove our destruction and overthrow. I have been deceived." I kind of wish he had said, "I had deceived myself." And he said, "In reference to this practice, it is wrong. It is a curse to mankind, and we shall have to leave the United States soon unless it can be put down and its practice stopped in the church." The central defect of evil is not the sin, because we are all sinners and fall short of the glory of God, but it's the refusal to acknowledge it. So let's talk a little bit about why we still struggle. I believe that we still hold an institutional shadow. Oftentimes when someone with a lot of power has unresolved shadow material, they pass it on to us, and because of our love and loyalty of the individual, of the good that was done, because I remember the shadow is inclusive of all the goodness, nobility, righteousness, and all of the badness, and all of the unresolved of that individual's shadow, we have a complicated relationship in having to manage what's never been resolved in the individual, especially one as influential as our founding prophet, Joseph Smith. And so as a product of that, I feel like the collective shadow that we still are managing has to do with these three components. First of all, hard power, patriarchy, and sexuality. And so while I believe that his legacy includes not only that which is absolutely beautiful, we're all here because we have a bond. There's something there, no matter what our relationship with the church is, as messy and as grief-ridden as it may be, we still have something deep in us that brings us to this room today. And so while there is beauty there, and while we have legacy and we have good memories, and there are really good things that are inclusive of this faith tradition, we still struggle. And like I said before, this is not just our church. The whole world struggles with hard power, patriarchy, and sexuality. We have some very unique struggles that I believe are the product of an unresolved shadow. Let's start with hard power. There's a difference between hard power and soft power. Hard power is coercive. Hard power has to do with pressure, guilt, eternal consequences, and fear tactics. Soft power has to do with influence that is based on equality, love, relationality, and free will. We struggle in the church with this idea of hard power. I also believe that there is a struggle that we have inherited, where power structures and hierarchies express this hard power over both men and women. It is my belief that when we exercise dominion over anybody in any human relationship, it is always unrighteous dominion. We are here as human beings to be seen as equal, to be beloved for ourselves. Power is neutral. Power is not the problem. It's when we use this power to control others. And so I believe that sometimes, because we have this sort of institutional collective shadow, we struggle with the idea of soft power. We have a hard time being relational. We can choose to have power over, or we can choose to be relational with. We cannot have both. And so that is, I think, what we really struggle with, is this idea of hard power. And I think that makes it hard for those in power to be accountable, to say they're sorry, because I think they mistakenly believe that they will lose their power. Whereas I think what they would find is they would gain their power. What they would turn their hard power into soft power. And we would be so touched by the reach of the hand and the apology, by the accountability, by the ability to say we made a mistake. We made a gross historical mistake. We're sorry. Okay, the next one is patriarchy. So these are all, as you can tell, kind of like first cousins of each other. But I believe that patriarchy is also at the heart of our struggles as a church. Once again, we can have patriarchy, which is male power over female. We can be patriarchal or we can be relational, but it's very, very challenging to be both. And I believe that as long as women are one down, and I believe as long as this problem of polygamy is not solved, the church is going to continue to suffer from unresolved and trauma. That is the product of the ghosts of polygamy. I think it hurts everybody. I don't think this is something that men... I think men are hurt by it. I think women are hurt by it. I think children are hurt by it. I believe that because of our struggles with patriarchy, microaggressions or just very small but significantly wounding things happen every single week at church when one is governed over and one is governed. And it's just something that I think is so much in the air that we breathe or the water that we swim in, that we don't necessarily recognize that it's not okay. It's not actually, it's not in keeping with why we are here to grow in love and in connection. I believe while there's a philosophy or a doctrine that was founded in the idea that women were a reward for men, we're objectifying one sex and we're turning the women into the objects and the men into the subjects. While this is embedded in our doctrine and theology, it hurts us all, and it's not in keeping with our capacity to grow eternally for both parties, for both genders. And I also believe with this issue of patriarchy that as long as our Heavenly Mother is silent, we are repressing divine womanhood. And let's finally talk a little bit about our very complicated relationship with sexuality. I'm a trauma therapist and have a lot of passion for helping people who have overcome either complex trauma or acute trauma or even generational trauma. I believe that we are the products of some generational trauma. The brain, what the brain does when it overcomes or it's working through, even sort of unconsciously, when it's working through trauma, it does one of two things. It oftentimes models or follows the behavior of the person that traumatized them to try to make sense of it in their brain, or oftentimes it reacts against it. Our church followed and modeled and tried to make this thing work, certainly up to the manifesto, and then of course I think it lasted like, what, 30 or 40 years thereafter, right, sort of unofficially. So I think we tried to make it work. We tried to believe that it was okay and make it okay. And then what happened, I think was, and I'm not a historian, so I believe it was the 1920s, 1930s that sort of the pendulum swung. And while we, in the polygamy era, were really, relatively speaking, very sexually liberal, right, for the times, we became later on, I think, very, very ultra sexually conservative, which I believe is probably somehow wrapped up in our really big struggles that we're having with what I would consider our ultra conservative stance with the LGBTQ issues, is that we're really, really sort of fixated on this dogma that I kind of think is perhaps maybe a reaction from unresolved trauma that happened from polygamy. Our relationship with sex, I mean, I guess everyone, or at least a lot of religions' relationship with sex is very fraught. I think we have some special fraughtness to our relationship with sex. And I believe this is a product of the collective shadow that we're carrying and trying to resolve and really struggling with. My belief in how to resolve this, I don't have an answer. If only I did, right? But I do believe that the most correct theology around eternity and sexuality is an embrace of the unknown. I do not think we understand. We don't know what it's going to look like over there, but I think we do know that the nature of God is to love. and to not exclude and marginalize hurting populations. And so if we can expand our theology to embrace more love, more inclusion, that would be more in keeping with the nature of God. And I believe that the struggle is in part because we carry this unresolved shadow that is inclusive of patriarchy, sexuality, and hard power. Just to close, what do we do? How do we deal with this? I have a lot of different things to call it, but today I'm going to call it value-driven insubordination, which is we have to have the courage to say, this is not okay. We have to have the courage to call out what we see, what we feel, where we see struggle. I heard in an earlier lecture today something about there's a difference between deep loyalty to membership as opposed to deep loyalty to discipleship, and I really, really like that. True disciples of Jesus Christ advocate for the things that Jesus Christ would have us believe and do and behave and have courage to stand up for that which does not feel good and right. And these shadows, I think, are the things that help us kind of understand why we struggle. What we cannot face will catch us from behind. When we gain the true strength to acknowledge our imperfect moral condition, we are no longer possessed by its demons. To the extent that we become accountable, we can overcome shadow. I believe in healing. I believe in the atonement. I believe in redemption. I believe that shadows can be healed and that relationality can be replaced by this closedness, this sense of, I don't want to look at that. That's not who I am as a church. And yet the thing of it is, that is who we are. It's who we are. It's what we're managing. It's what we're not managing very well. If we can embrace our shadows and come to really, really have the courage to look at them and be accountable and do differently and said I was wrong, I'm sorry, then all we're doing is actually allowing the atonement to do its work with us and for us at the institutional level. The only safe nations, including any kind of a collective, so I'm going to just replace this with the only safe churches, are those who systematically inoculate themselves by a free press and a vocal prophetic minority against the intoxication of divine destinies and sanctified paranoia. And it is my belief that we get to be the vocal prophetic minority. That's us. That's us who are trying to navigate the complexity of membership in a beautiful but wounded institution and discipleship so that we can acknowledge what's actually going on and be the prophetic vocal minority. Again, in an earlier session today, such a good day, someone said, I wish I could quote him, or I think his name was Mark. He said there are two churches in every church. There is the church of the structure and the institution, the hierarchy, and then there are those of us who are trying to be faithful and be disciples, but who are standing up for something that doesn't feel right. And so I think that's what all of us need to sort of figure out, how we can uniquely participate in being that part. And that's kind of how I sort of stumbled into this opportunity and the things that I'm doing. I started a podcast 6 months ago that addresses and tackles as a therapist what I'm seeing. And I'm trying to find a space or help people find a space. I'm trying to help people navigate this really tender, painful place in the middle where they're trying to navigate truth and the beauty of the church, but also the unresolved complexity that doesn't feel like there's a safe place to handle it. It's called Latter-day Struggles. So I'd love for you to jump on there and become a part of this community where we're trying to help one another lift our church and overcome these struggles. And finally, this is David Stendel Rast, and he says, when you are through with your tradition, it must be different from where you found it, or else you have failed. It is your responsibility to make your religious tradition, whatever it may be, Christian or otherwise, more truly religious by the time you are through with it. This is the great challenge that we all face.